Hello and welcome to the Trauma Super Conference. My name is Jaya Bristow and I'm one of your hosts. And today I am very, very happy to be joined by Dr. Liz Powell. Welcome, Liz.
Hi, good to see you, Jaya.
Good to see you too. So Dr. Liz believes that great sex can change the world. They are the author of Building Open Relationships, a sex educator, and a licensed psychologist specializing in queer, kinky, and non-monogamous relationships. You can read Dr. Liz's full bio below this video. And if you're interested in a conversation on trauma-informed non-monogamy, check out my interview with Mel Cassidy. But today, Dr. Liz and I are going to be talking about trauma and kink. So let's start off, Liz, by what is it you mean by kink? Because that's often associated with like sexual deviancy and we're talking about trauma and our mind can go to all kinds of places. So let's start with that.
Kink is actually a really tough term to define in a lot of ways because it's a huge umbrella. Kink basically refers to any practices around sex or sensation or relating that are outside of a very standard, traditional, what we would call vanilla monogamous kind of script. So kink can include anything from sensation or impact play, where you're using either your body or implements to create sensations in someone. Those can be pleasurable or painful or a mix of both. It can include domination and submission, where people voluntarily offer up some control of some aspects of their life to someone or receive control over aspects of someone's life. It can include bondage. It can include things like wrestling or playing. It can include role playing. There's a whole lot of different things it can be, but it's basically a way to think about things outside of what we often call the sacred circle of sexuality, which is like monogamous sex between people who are married, usually in the missionary position, definitely straight and cisgender. And so a lot of things can be kink. It's about challenging taboos. It's about challenging norms and breaking out of those boxes.
Fantastic. I love it. And I think you've done a very good job at defining something you said was difficult to define. So, and so I was surprised when we first talked about doing a talk on kink and trauma, because so I'm curious, what is the connection between, well, what you're calling kink or any form of alternative sexual practice and trauma?
I think a lot of people who are not in the kink community or who haven't explored kink themselves often have a lot of misperceptions about kink. One of the most common ones I hear, especially from like rad fem leaning folks, is that like kink is abuse. It's a way to like normalize, they would say, men abusing women. And that is not what it is. Kink is not traumatizing necessarily. As with any activity, if done from a bad place, if done with poor intentions, it can be traumatizing. Or if it hits on someone's landmines, it can be traumatizing. But like a trip to the grocery store can be traumatizing. The way that we relate with someone romantically can be traumatizing. So kink is not necessarily something that creates or perpetuates trauma. It can be something that people who have experienced trauma use as a like well-negotiated and relatively safe container to explore and work through and almost re-experience in a healing way some aspects of things that have been traumatizing for them before. I tell a story in a lot of my classes about humiliation play, that when I was married, I got married when I was very young, 23, to a man, and we were going to be mostly monogamous, and he was very emotionally abusive to me for the entirety of our relationship. And one of the ways that he was abusive towards me is he would talk about like not feeling attracted to me or talk about like me not being good enough for him in certain ways. And after we separated, I was doing kink play with one of my lovers, and we did a scene that was all about him talking about how like I wasn't doing a good enough job and like I wasn't hot enough and like things weren't good enough for this to work for him. But as soon as the scene was over, he held me and told me like how hard it had been to like not just come immediately and to not like just immediately feel great, like have an amazing time, and how hard it was to stay in character. And so seeing that contrast between what the reality was and what I had been told or what I had experienced in that moment was hugely healing for me. Because kink, when done well, is very clearly negotiated with clear boundaries, clear understandings, clear ways of communicating in the moment, even if we're not sticking with like normal yes means yes, no means no kind of constraints, it is a space where you can take the stuff that is scary for you or hard for you or painful for you and play with it rather than it being a thing that you have to avoid or are afraid of or are trying to keep away from. So it can provide you this container in which to re-experience and re-explore things that have been painful for you in the past.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think there's a few really important elements in what you're saying. So number one is, as you're saying, kink isn't just about going beyond traditional sex. It's about going beyond traditional sex in a really safe way with really clear negotiated guidelines, boundaries, safe words, whatever one needs in that moment. And so then it provides a container, a very safe container, to be able to explore traumatic elements. And I think there's something particularly in what you've just said, in the example you gave with your lover, where you were exploring this dynamic with your abusive ex, where you talked about, but then afterwards, this person held you and looked after you and checked in with you. So let's talk a little bit more about aftercare and why that's so important to not reinforce trauma patterns, or especially sexual trauma.
I mean, one thing that I would say before we talk about aftercare is that when we talk about safety as it relates to sex or to kink, I prefer to think about things in terms of like risk awareness and risk assessments and like what level of risk we're willing to accept, because nothing is ever actually safe. Like, even if people come in with the best of intentions and the best negotiation and the best possible skills, we're all still messy humans and there's still going to be risk. And so what I like about kink is that people make much more of an effort to be explicit about like what the risks are and how they're going to mitigate them than a lot of people do, particularly in like mainstream heterosexual monogamous dating world. In mainstream hetero monogamous dating world, there's a whole bunch of stuff about like not explicitly negotiating, right? Or you say, we're going to be monogamous, but don't talk about what that means. Whereas in kink, you're required to do more explicit negotiation, which creates a greater risk awareness. And I think because you know that what you're doing is risky, you are more attuned to risk and more prepared to handle things potentially going in challenging ways. And aftercare is one of those things that we do to help handle challenging experiences. Aftercare, for those who don't know, is that after you do what we call a kink scene, which is a like interaction set, basically, which may have like a set amount of time or a set kind of activities that we're using. At the end of it, people come out of their roles, and generally the person who was the top or the dominant, so either the person who was giving the action or who was taking some amount of like control or decision-making power, will help the person who was bottoming or the submissive to kind of come back into a normal headspace and like check in with them about how they're doing and see what they need. And so aftercare can include things like cuddling, or some people have like a really soft blanket they like to wrap themselves in. It can include talking about the scene and what went well and what you want differently next time. It can include giving snacks and water to make sure that people's bodies are doing okay. Because when we do things like sex or kink, our bodies burn through a ton of our fuel and a ton of our water source. And so it's actually really common for people to end up having like a blood sugar crash as soon as they come out of a scene. So we want to have some snacks so that there's food to replenish our body. And it's about caring for the bodies and the minds and the like soul or spirit or whatever we want to call it of the people who were involved in the scene, so that they can then come back to like a normal day-to-day headspace and move back into the world and be okay. Aftercare, particularly if you're playing with stuff that relates to a trauma or to anything like psychological dynamics or any heavier kinds of play or stuff that's more intense, is a really good way to ensure that we can kind of like come out of role and like come back to reality and check in about what reality is. In kink, a lot of times we are pretending to be mean people or people who are doing cruel things for cruel reasons. And it's play. You know, Dan Savage used to say that kink is like cops and robbers for grownups with your pants off. And it's a game. And the same way that, you know, at the end of a play, the actors are not still the person they were portraying, the person we portray in a kink scene maybe parts of ourselves, but like a specific version of that or a specific role that we have put on for that time. And aftercare is where we get to discard those roles and reconnect as real humans. And it gives both people or all people involved an opportunity to just check in and see, like, how are we each doing? What do we each need to feel good here? Is there stuff that's still causing us some problems or stress? How do we move forward out of this? Like, what do we want to do in order to make sure that we are all taken care of? And for most folks, aftercare also usually involves a check-in a couple days later, because sometimes it takes a couple days for stuff to kind of settle or shake out, or for you to see that something is still sitting with you wrong that you want some support around. And I think this very explicit framework of, we're going to do something that is intense, and then we're going to be very particular about taking care of each other afterwards, is something super helpful for people who have experienced trauma. Because in trauma, a lot of times the experience is something really intense happens, and then I'm supposed to go back to regular life. And I haven't gotten to talk about it, and I haven't gotten to process it, and I'm just expected to go be a person now. And that huge shift between I am in danger and I am not okay to I have to talk about the weather and the local sports team is really challenging for a lot of people. So aftercare instead creates this very intentional framework of, we've done something intense and we are going to explicitly take time to process and recover from it and set up an expectation that we will reconnect if there is still stuff bugging us.
Fantastic. And so I'm really hearing like some of the key elements you're talking about how what's really important around kink and alternative sexual practices is setting the safety before, so that kind of explicit communication during, so having a bunch of the elf, you know, safe words. So even though it's, and making sure you're remembering it's play. So no matter how cruel it gets, it's not real, or how intense it gets. And at any point, if it feels too much, we can like snap out of it. And then aftercare, which isn't just immediately 10 minutes afterwards, you're all right, yeah, I'm all right, all right, bye. And you know, it's this ongoing, and how that can be that just setting that element of safety, that container of safety before, during, and after an intense event can really be supportive to those who have a lot of trauma.
Yeah.
And so
I think the explicitness of negotiation there is another helpful thing, I think, for a lot of people with trauma, because I think a lot of folks who have experienced trauma have a lot of fears about like taking up too much space or about being a bother. And they may be experiencing something that's causing them discomfort that they wish they could process with a partner, but that they feel like they shouldn't, because it like would be, they'd be like bringing the mood down, or they'd be like causing a problem, or like they can just hold it. And instead there is this very strong expectation that like, we will talk about what's coming up because we know stuff is going to come up. So we're going to process it together because that's the way to do it.
That sounds really supportive. And so I guess one of my questions is, when and with whom is it a good idea to practice kink, right? Because number one, it sounds like probably a one-night stand is not the best time to start exploring all your sexual fantasies and most kinky desires if you're not then going to have that connection with the person afterwards to create that aftercare. And for people, you know, we've touched upon this already, but people who have a lot of trauma, especially sexual traumas, you know, it sounds like it can be safe, but maybe there are certain things they should be doing or shouldn't be doing or should be aware of. So let's talk about when and with whom it's a good idea to explore.
That's a very like person by person determination. So like, let's take a one night stand example. If you're talking about like a rando that you meet at a bar, then like, yeah, one night stand is probably a terrible idea to explore stuff with. However, if we're talking about like someone who my friends know, who they've known for years in the kink community and they've vouched for, and they know how that person plays, and like, we've just decided to hook up, that might actually be a safe person. So I think there's an element of like, how well do you know this person? Something I teach a lot when I talk about kink and I'm teaching kink is that I think another big misconception that people who aren't in the community have is that like every kink scene that you do, every time you play, you're trying to play like as hard as possible, like from 0 to 10, you want to see how high you can get. And the goal is eventually to get to a 10. And like, that is not true. Like your kink play can be maxing out at a 3 or a 4 every time. And that is totally fine. You're still doing the kink. You're not doing it wrong. And so I think from this like risk aware and this, you know, harm reduction kind of perspective, if what you want to do is explore kink with people, asking yourself questions about like, how well do I know this person? Is this someone who is like a known community member? Is this someone who is a complete stranger? What do I know about how this person interacts in sexual and kink and relational spaces? What do I know about how much this person is aware of stuff around trauma and capable of like seeing landmines and addressing them themselves? How much do I know about myself and what'll happen if I have a tough reaction and this person ends up unavailable to help me with it for whatever reason? What other supports do I have around me? And so looking at like, what are all of the various risks involved? What are all the various supports or mitigation factors involved? And making decisions from there. In general, I would say your first few times playing with someone, don't play as hard. Again, unless it's like a very well-vetted person, unless it's someone who like you super know in the community, or unless it's like you're coming back to your huge support network for the next several weeks, the less you know someone, probably the less intensely you want to play. The more you know someone, the more you're probably going to feel some sense of trust and ability to go to deeper places with them. The more supports that you have, the easier it is to play deeply, because then even if something happens to this other person who you're playing with, you have more people around you to help you out if something goes poorly for you. The more that you have worked on your stuff and that like you have your own footing and your own strategies for dealing with any challenging feelings that come up, the deeper you can go with people. And so looking at it as like, what are the risks? What are the things I have to offset those? And making that decision on like a big scale rather than like a light switch, I think is really helpful. Because I think that, you know, for most folks, if we take this like abstinence approach of like, don't do kink with a one night stand, people are still going to do it. They're just going to feel more shame around it. And that's going to prevent them from seeking resources and support if something does go poorly. So if we think about it instead in terms of harm reduction, like what are the potential harms that could happen? What are we doing to mitigate those? How do we feel about the risk picture that's left? That gives you a lot more leeway to make decisions and to find what feels right for you.
That makes a lot of sense. And I really appreciate you explaining all of that. And I think, you know, it's so important when any kind of time that we go beyond socially ascribed boxes, beyond traditional boxes, which is Beyond Boxes is the name of my podcast, because it's something I like talking about a lot. But so with sexual practices, especially if we're going beyond the norm or beyond traditional sex, then it's about that kind of thing of understanding suddenly we're beyond the box. What are we doing? And it's not a one size fits all. That's the whole point of going beyond boxes, is that it's not a one size fits all. So it's really tuning in and checking in with oneself, with the person we're involved with, or people we're involved with, and figuring out what's true in that moment. And I think it's really great to remember that there are different definitions of a one night stand as well. And it's not always just some rando that we meet at on the pub.
Well, and I would apply this within the box too. You know, I think one of the things that we see, particularly here in the States where the like abstinence only education is much stronger, is that because there's this idea that if you're doing like cisgender, heterosexual, monogamous kind of sex and dating, you don't need to do a ton of explicit negotiation. You don't need to do a ton of like actual risk assessment, aside from if you're like a cisgender woman and then every man is trying to rape you. And if you get raped, it's your fault, but don't be a prude and not put out, because then you're a terrible, frigid person that no one's going to love, right? There, the way that we even think about sexual and relational risk inside the box is still broken, right? I think everybody would benefit from taking this approach to the way that they look at sex and dating and relationships of what are the risks? Like realistically, what are the risks that I'm looking at here? What are the factors I can bring in for risk mitigation or to eliminate those risks? And how do I feel about that risk picture?
I couldn't agree more. I'm 100% with you on all of that. And I think it's also good to remember that whilst, you know, kink is going beyond sort of normative sexual practices, you know, I have friends who are cisgendered, heterosexual, and monogamous, who are also very kinky. It can happen. There is sometimes, you know, a crossover with those of us who are more queer or alternative, but not always. And so again, it doesn't really matter about the boxes or the labels. It matters about, you know, it's helpful for everyone in the world to ask those questions of themselves, whether during sex or any kind of relating, especially for those who are trauma survivors. And so would you say there are any kinky practices that you would recommend for people trying to, I know, once again, it depends on the person, I guess, but is there any specific, kink practices that you would recommend for people working on trauma, especially sexual trauma?
Again, that's super personal, because I think that what feels safe and what feels dangerous to people, even people who have experienced the same traumas, is often very, very different. I think, you know, the shorthand I use a lot of times is like, start low, go slow. Start at a low intensity, amp it up very slowly to see like where you start hitting things. Different people are going to find themselves, you know, pulled towards different kinds of kink activities just naturally, depending on, you know, what they're into and who they are. And so I don't know that there's any particular like single kink practice that is going to be more helpful for some folks than others. I think it's much more about the overall kink practice of learning to negotiate and be really upfront and honest about what does and doesn't work for you. A big thing I see in the kink community in general, but in particular among folks who have trauma and who are bottoms, is that people don't use their safe words as often as they should. So a safe word, for those who don't know, is basically a word or a phrase that you use during a kink scene to indicate that you need stuff to stop so you can check in and see what's going on. And the reason we use safe words is that sometimes the way that we're playing, no doesn't mean no and stop doesn't mean stop. So we have special language that we come up with that allows us to be in those roles and still have a way to communicate clearly that we need things to change. Almost everyone I talk to in the kink community, particularly folks newer to the community, is hesitant or afraid of using their safe word because they don't want to like ruin the moment. They want to like be able to like be okay and like they can deal with it. They can endure. And sex and kink are not endurance sports, unless that's like your particular goal. But usually the endurance we're going for is not like how much pain can I tolerate that I'm not enjoying. So I think in general, this practice of like using negotiation skills, being honest about where you're at, checking in about what's working and what's not is really important. I'm a big fan of, you know, psychological play. So using the ways that we talk about things and that we frame things as a way to like interact with our shame and our fears. And some people hate that. So I think it's tough to say like, is there a particular kink practice? Because just what people are into varies super widely. What works well for people with trauma versus not so well for them is really different. So I think it's just hard to like narrow that down to one thing.
That's understandable. And that makes a lot of sense. And I guess, you know, in what I'm hearing that it can be supportive. And you've also we talked earlier about safety practices at the beginning, like pre, like negotiating, you know, structures and guidelines and stuff. We've talked about aftercare, and now you've just touched a little bit on how to create the actual during the act, during the event, how that can be safe, including things like safe words. Are there any other practices for how to ensure safety during sexual practices?
Check-ins, tons of check-ins. So in kink, most people who top will do a combination of like observing body language and how the person is moving and reacting, and like actual explicit check-ins. And explicit check-ins, depending upon how you play and who you're playing with, can be like completely out of role check-ins where you say to someone, green, yellow, red, where are you at? Or 0 to 10, where are we at for intensity right now? Or they can be things that you do in role, where you come up with like ways within the roles that you've taken on to check in about things or to communicate about things. I'm a big fan of explicit check-ins personally, because I think the like 10 seconds it takes to check in isn't going to pull people so significantly out of role that they can't get back. And like, a lot of times my brain space is too full to come up with like extensive ways of checking in role. So, you know, I'm a fan of explicit check-ins that are out of role, but people do things differently. So check-ins is a really big one. Again, monitoring, specifically the top or the dominant, doing a lot of monitoring of like how the bottom or submissive's body is doing. What's their breathing like? Are they tensing or relaxing? Are they pulling away or pushing towards? Are they going silent? Are they still talking? It can be helpful to develop safe words that you can use if someone goes nonverbal, particularly if people have a tendency to go nonverbal, which a lot of trauma survivors do. For instance, Shay and Stefanos, who are some amazing kink educators out of the San Francisco Bay Area, they have a system that they use where you have like your hands. And the system that they created was one where it takes motion to indicate a green rather than staying still indicates a green. Because if someone has gone nonverbal and they freeze, they may not be able to move to indicate that there is a problem, right? So for them, green is both hands, yellow is one hand, red is no hands, right? But different ways that you can check in and see, how are we doing? Are we okay? Do you need more or less? Do you need some water? Do we need to adjust your position? People who do a lot of bondage or rope plays will often have things that they have the person do with their body to double check that there's not any impingement on nerves or any cutting off of blood flow. So just being very aware during the scene of like how things are going, how bodies are doing, how brains are doing, rather than just kind of like diving in and going until we feel like we're done.
That makes a lot of sense. So check-ins, monitoring, safe words, safe gestures, which are nonverbal. One that was really helpful for me when I had a partner who was really into martial arts was the double tap, because in martial arts, when you literally can't move, if you're pinned down and you double tap, it means like, get off me, I'm choking or can't breathe or can't move or whatever it is. So like all these like nonverbal cues sound like they're just as important, especially for people who go nonverbal because of trauma or feel shy or ashamed to use explicit safe words. So it's really helpful to hear this list of things people can do. And I am wondering if you have, well, actually before this, I'm curious, do you consider kink a form of therapy in helping heal trauma?
I mean, I think that kink is one of many things that can be therapeutic. Is it therapy in that it is like a thing I would prescribe to people who have trauma? Like, not necessarily. There are a lot of things that are therapeutic. A bath can be therapeutic. For some people, a nice glass of wine can be therapeutic. A chat with your friend can be therapeutic. Is it therapy? Not necessarily. And there are people who are looking at ways of incorporating various somatic body focus practices or even things related to kink for more specifically therapeutic kinds of practices. So like bondissage is one that's very common, which is a kink involved massage healing practice, right? Mm. So bondissage is very cool. There's some amazing people who practice it. There are people who do like specifically therapeutic kink that is like one of the things that they're very into is like people have stuff that they want to work through and they know that they're very good at holding a container for that. So I think, again, it can be therapeutic, but it is not necessarily the same thing as therapy. And this is not to say that like therapy is the one size fits all for everybody. That is absolutely not true. One of the biggest complaints I have about people who share my profession of professional therapist is that often they think therapy is the solution to everything. And like therapy can be helpful for a lot of things, but it is not the only way. It's not the only good thing. And like for a lot of people, their trauma isn't just about like the specific event they experienced. It's the intersection of that specific event or events and like larger societal structures of oppression that create day-to-day problems for them. And so like therapy can't fix racism. Therapy can't fix sexism. We can provide support around it. But I think when we're looking at like what is helpful for trauma, not everything is going to be therapy. That doesn't mean it's not helpful. And so I think looking at like what is therapeutic, what is healing for you, what feels like it's in alignment for you can be good. And to be frank, talk therapy is great, but it isn't everything. There are a lot of things with trauma that we can't fix in a therapy room, because particularly if your trauma is about a relationship, relational trauma has to heal in relationship. And therapy relationships are a kind of relationship, but they're not the same. And so kink can be a way to address trauma in ways that we can't in a therapy room. Like if someone is afraid of being pinned down, I can't enact that as their therapist. That's not ethical. That's not what I'm trained to do. Like, that's not a way to do it. But they could play with someone who can do that and who can help them explore that in a way that feels good for them. So I think that it's complementary things rather than like all of it is therapy.
I think that's a really good distinction between a form of therapy and something that's therapeutic. And, you know, as you say, therapy can't heal everything. But first of all, there's a ton of different forms of therapy within psychotherapy, within talk therapy, but just, you know, all kinds of other therapies. There's somatic approaches, there's talk approaches. And so again, that it might be a helpful somatic complementary approach without necessarily being itself a form of therapy, I think is a really helpful and clear distinction. So my final question then is, do you have practical tips for how people can get started with exploring beyond traditional sex and start exploring kink?
I mean, it's still kind of COVID time. It's still mostly COVID time. So that's much more complicated to answer. The answer that I used to give would be that in pretty much any major city, there's going to be some kind of a kink community that you can find and like get in touch with. One of the best ways to get involved in kink communities is through events that we call munches. So a munch is a get together of kinky people where there is no play. So rather than it being at the dungeon with people in their leather and collars, it's at a coffee shop and you have coffee and chat and you can meet people in a much less intense way, right? It's generally out of protocol. So nobody is in role. You don't have to worry about like who you can talk to and who you can't. You don't have to worry about like seeing a bunch of genitals that you didn't sign up for. You can just go and hang out with people and meet some people as a way to have folks to like talk to or say hi to if you do end up going to a kink event later. FetLife is the most common website people recommend for connecting with other kinky folk. It's like a social network for kinky people. The thing I will say about FetLife is that it has its pros and its cons. The user interface is very like early 2000s internet and has not ever changed and probably will never change. And it has some security issues. For instance, someone created a piece of software a few years ago that was able to pull like the usernames of every user who was a woman under a certain age. It's also not like if you're used to navigating something like a Twitter or a Facebook, it doesn't work like that. It's very particular in terms of how it functions and how you get to connect with people. So it's got a different set of like ways to search or connect. It's got a different set of social norms. So it can, there can be a bit of a learning curve if you do decide to join FetLife. There are also a lot of Facebook groups if you like to Facebook. Twitter is another good place to find other kinky people. There's usually people having kink discussions on there. You can find people who are talking about different kinds of kinks and you can find them through a lot of different channels. There's usually hashtags that you can find that are related to those. So I think it's complicated. The thing about these alternative communities is that most of them make it a little bit challenging to actually get involved because there are some people who just want to come in and jerk off to other people doing things in a way that feels gross to the people involved. So, and another factor is that there can be very real consequences socially and in terms of employment for people who are kinky. So there tends to be a bit of a barrier to entry in order to really get involved with these communities because they're trying to keep each other safe and prevent someone from coming in and like outing them all to their employers or outing them all to their former spouses so they lose, you know, custody of their children. So just be prepared for it to take a little bit of time, for it to maybe be a little more challenging than you would think it would be. If there is like a dungeon space in your town, most of them will let you go if you pay the entry fee. And most of them, if they're good ones, will have people who are there as like greeters so that people who are new can get a tour of the space, get walked through the rules, and meet at least one person while they're there. It is still COVID. So if you're going to go, wear a mask, please be vaccinated. Don't be a jerk. But again, a lot of different ways to do it, more challenging during COVID times than not COVID times.
And I think as well as all those things, there's a certain apps that are supportive for that, certain dating apps or things like Field or things like that, where people can connect I'm also curious about people who maybe feel a bit nervous to join an alternative kinky community, but have either a partner or multiple partners that, and you know, or are in a relationship or relationships and want to start exploring kink with those specific people, but everyone involved is a bit new. How would you suggest those kind of people get started with each other?
So there's a brand new book that just came out. I'm trying to look up the actual title. But Kate Sloan, who's one of the Dildworks, just released a book called 101 Kinky Things Even You Can Do. And so it walks through a lot of different things that are kinky and like ways to try it out with people in your life. And it's very accessible to people who are brand new. So it's an awesome book that you can read in the comfort of your home and no one has to know you're doing it. Other books that I really like are the new topping book and the new bottoming book by Dossie Easton and Janet Hardy. Those are less technique focused books and more about like what it is to top or bottom and what it is to be in the kink scene. So those are really good books to read for that information. Other things that you could do, don't use 50 Shades as your guide. 50 Shades is a book that has done a great job of like introducing kink to a lot of people in the world, and it did not do a super great job of it. So, you know, find other sources that are more helpful. If you're looking for really good kinky erotica, Kit Rocha, which is the pen name of two authors, they do an amazing series called the Beyond series that is really hot, kinky, polyamorous, queer sex. And it talks explicitly about things like negotiation and safe words. So like really, really good stuff. Laurel K. Hamilton, a lot of people like her stuff for kind of kinkier sex smut, if you're looking for that. There's a lot of stuff out there. What I would say is read a few different things, try a few different things. The Society of Janus has chapters in most major cities. They usually also have like intro to kink classes that people can take. Kink.com has a whole education series that has a bunch of different classes on different aspects of kink that you can take. And they're all really awesome. Kink Academy, which is run by Princess Callie, has a bunch of like video on demand classes that you can take. So there's tons of resources out there for finding different things and finding out how to explore different things.
Fantastic. Those sound like some really great resources. And then there's, of course, all the elements that we've talked about today about making sure to communicate and be really open and clear with each other, negotiate boundaries, talk about safe words and gestures, have lots of check-ins during sex, have check-ins afterwards, checking in again 24 hours afterwards, 48 hours afterwards, a week afterwards, a month afterwards, however long it takes, especially if it's a regular partner, check in before and after each act. Don't feel like, I guess, not every sexual experience has to be kinky. Remembering what you were talking about scales, like you can start slow and build up, and all these great tips that you've been given throughout this interview. And then I know that you also, I think, have lead workshops on kink. So mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us a bit more about your work and how people can find out about it?
Yes. So you can find all of my stuff at drlizpowell.com. I have a class that I teach called Shamefully Sexy or Hot Healthy Humiliation, depending on where I'm teaching it. And I teach it every so often. These days, most recently, it's been through the like kink.com workshop series. I'm looking at putting that online. It's just a matter of, you know, finding time to record it, all that stuff. But yeah, I teach stuff through there, and everything that I'm going to be doing, you can always find at drlizpowell.com. I also post about it on my Twitter, which is at drlizpowell, and my Instagram, which is also at drlizpowell.
Fantastic. And I think you have a couple of other websites and work that mm-hmm. you do. Do you want to tell us about those?
Yes. So I talk about non-monogamy and polyamory with my amazing colleague, Kevin Patterson, who is the award-winning author of Love's Not Colorblind. We have a website, unfuckyourpolyamory.com, and we have our class up there, which is a 6-week course on how to do non-monogamy in a way that centers ideas about autonomy and healthy interdependence rather than coercion and control, and looks also at societal structures and how they impact the ways that we do love and relationships.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Liz. I really appreciate it, and I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.